Great. Let me just catch you up with where we are in the story of Acts. So where we are in the story of Acts is we're following the Apostle Paul. So Paul is one of the early leaders of the church. He meets Jesus dramatically on the road to Damascus. You might have heard the story. Jesus appears to him. He has been an enemy of Christians. He becomes a follower of Jesus at that point. And he spends his whole life after that time going around to different cities, basically planting churches, setting up new churches that can kind of encourage the Christians there, that can share the good news of Jesus. That's what he spends life doing. But we join him in this last leg. And what happened was he went to Jerusalem. He wanted to go to Jerusalem for a number of years, and he finally gets there. But after just a few days in Jerusalem, he gets arrested. And he gets taken out of Jerusalem to a place called Caesarea, and he's in prison there for over 2 years. So imagine this. You spend your time working towards, looking forward to getting to Jerusalem, where you can share the good news of Jesus with people there, where you can hear from the other apostles, where you can build each other up. And then after just a few days, you're arrested. You spend the next couple of years in jail. And so what we have is he has this collection of like interviews with governors and different leaders, all trying to work out what to do with him. There's no kind of real charge against him, so they can't really convict him of anything. But the people from Jerusalem, the Jewish leaders there, they really dislike Paul and they don't want him released. So they're in this kind of slightly tricky position of we can't release him because it'll upset the Jewish people and the leaders in Jerusalem, but we also can't find any reason to keep him. So that's where we are. And what happened, what we were looking at last week was a story whereby Paul is interviewed by the governor of the region at the time, and he is worried he's not going to get a fair trial. He's not going to get a fair trial because kind of all the parties there are just conspiring against him. And he also wants Christianity to be legal in the Roman Empire, because that will make a big difference to all Christians in the Roman Empire. If the Roman Empire decide Christianity is legal, then Christians will be able to worship freely without being at risk of being thrown to lions and all the stuff that happens to Christians. So he's worried he's not going to get a fair trial. He wants Christianity to be made legal, and he also really wants to go to Rome, because God said to him, I want you to go to Rome. And so what Paul does is he appeals to Caesar, the highest authority in the land. It's the equivalent of I don't know, you hear about people like appealing to the Supreme Court or that kind of thing. It's that. It's like, what's the highest place I can appeal to? He appeals to Caesar. And because he's appealed to Caesar, they now have to find a way to ship him out to Rome so that he can stand before Caesar and be an answer for what he's been charged of and defend Christianity. So that's where we are in the story. And we're going to pick it up at verse 1, and we're just going to read that it's split into three sections. You'll see it in the Bible. So you've got him setting sail for Rome. So you've got the kind of the voyage and then the storm and then the shipwreck. So we're going to do it bit by bit. We're going to look at that kind of the voyage to begin with. So a ship arrives. Paul goes on its way. So let's start reading in verse 1. When it was decided that we would sail for Italy, Paul and some of the prisoners were handed over to a centurion named Julius, who belonged to the Imperial Regiment. We boarded a ship from somewhere completely unpronounceable, about to sail for ports along the coast of the province of Asia, and we put out to sea. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us. The next day we landed at Sidon, and Julius, in kindness to Paul, allowed him to go to his friends so they might provide for his needs. From there we put out to sea again and passed to the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. When we had sailed across the open sea off the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy and put us on board. We made slow headway for many days and had difficulty arriving off Cnidus, maybe? Cnidus, I don't know. When the wind did not allow us to hold our course, we sailed to the lee of Crete, opposite Salmone. We moved along the coast with difficulty and came to a place called Fair Havens, near the town of Lycia. Much time had been lost, and sailing had already become dangerous, because by now it was after the Day of Atonement. So Paul warned them, "Men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo, and to our own lives also." But the centurion, instead of listening to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and of the owner of the ship. Since the harbour was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided that we should sail on, hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. This was a harbour in Crete facing both southwest and northwest. So, just to summarize what's going on here. They set sail And what happens? It's pretty slow progress. Okay, so they don't make great time. So we're told in verse 4 that the winds are against them in the first leg. I don't know much about sailing, but I kind of get the idea that if the wind's against you, that's not very helpful. And then we're told in verse 7, on the second leg, they make slow headway for many days. So they've basically made very slow progress on this journey so far. And this means that by the time they're due to set off on the next leg of their voyage, it is already considered to be the dangerous season for sailing. So basically the way sailing worked at those times is over winter you just wouldn't sail. It was just too dangerous. There's no point sailing over the winter months because too many storms, too likely to get shipwrecked. And then in the autumn, as kind of autumn progresses, that was what was known as the dangerous season. Sometimes you would, sometimes you wouldn't. You'd take your chances if you did, though. And so that's what they mean by saying it was already after the Day of Atonement. That's their way of signaling it's at this dangerous time of traveling. It's not quite where you wouldn't travel at all, but it's not going to be that safe. And this leaves the centurion, who's guarding Paul, in a slightly tricky position because he wants to keep going. He wants to find a good place where they can harbour and spend the winter in rather than this rubbish port that they're in now. So he wants to keep going, but it is getting increasingly dangerous. And on the one hand, he has Paul. And Paul, you'll see it in verse, wherever it is, 10. Paul warns him, look, this voyage is too dangerous. It's going to be disastrous. It's going to go badly. You shouldn't do it. So he's got, on the one hand, he's got Paul. But listen to what he's got on the other hand. On the other hand, he has the pilot and the owner of the ship, both of who are advising him, no, it's going to be fine. You can just press on. It's going to be okay. And this leaves the centurion in that situation that we'll have all been in at some point of asking the question, who am I going to listen to? You'll have been there. You'll have had that time where you've had two different people advising two different things, and you've had to work out who you're gonna listen to. I was trying to think of examples of this during the week, and there's so many of them. But I often get accused that my illustrations are both like outdated because I'm old and outdated, and also a little bit too niche, so people don't follow it. This is what I'm gonna go with. I can't do anything about being outdated, so I'm gonna go outdated, but I'm gonna go less niche. I'm gonna go to The Lion King, right? Because I reckon most people in the room will have seen The Lion King. I don't know how familiar you are with the story, but it follows the story of Simba, who runs away from the Pride Lands. And when he's away from there, he meets two animals. What are they? Warthog and a meerkat type thing? I don't know. But he meets them, Timon and Pumbaa. You'll know if you've seen the film. And they teach him a whole way of living. You'll know it. Hakuna Matata, right? No worries for the rest of your days. An easygoing, responsible-free lifestyle. And he embraces this wholeheartedly. He's like, yes, this is the way to live your life. Don't worry about the past. Put the past behind you. Just crack on with what's in front of you. Don't overthink it. Just get on. And this is all going fine until childhood sweetheart Nala turns up. And she turns up and she says, no, wait a minute. The Pride Land's gone disastrously wrong. Scar's taken over. He's let the hyenas in. There's no vegetation left anymore. It's all terrible. You have to come back and you've got to sort this out. You're the rightful king. The whole story of the Lion King basically hinges on whether Simba is going to listen to Timon and Pumbaa or Nala and the crazy baboon guy. Like, that's what it depends on. Who's he going to listen to? Like, is he going to listen to Timon and Pumbaa or to Nala and Rafiki? See, I do know his name. And so that's the story. A life without responsibilities, no worries, just cracking on, or a life where he's going to take his responsibilities seriously and go back. Who's he going to listen to? Now, you probably haven't been in exactly that situation, but whilst it's true for Simba, it's true for the centurion in this story. Two people, who's he going to listen to? Is he going to listen to Paul, or is he going to listen to the pilot and the owner of the ship? I just want to pause it for a minute, because I just want to make this absolutely clear for each one of you. There are few things that will shape your life more dramatically than the people you listen to. Who you choose to listen to will be one of the most formative things about your life. In some ways, all of our beliefs, all of our actions, all of our ways of interpreting the world are determined by the people that we chose to listen to and the people we chose to ignore. That's your whole entire worldview is based on that question. Who are you going to listen to and who are you going to ignore? And you've built your entire view of the world based on a whole load of people you decided to listen to and a whole load of other people that you decided to ignore. That's how your worldview is constructed. You listen to some people, you ignored some others. And that means that this is one of the crucial questions of life. Who am I actually going to listen to? So anyway, let's get back to Acts 27. The whole story rests on the decision that they are now going to make. To sail or not to sail, that is the question. Are they going to listen to Paul or the pilot? Now, I just want to pause it for a minute, because just put yourself in the shoes of the centurion at this moment. Okay, just imagine you're there with this question in front of you. Would you have done anything that different? Because just remind yourself, who are the voices calling you to set sail? Because those voices have a lot of weight behind them. Firstly, you've got the pilot and the owner. So presumably the pilot knows something about sailing. You'd certainly hope so. He's what you might call an expert. So you've got the expert, and the expert saying, hey, set sail. Seems pretty credible. You've also got the owner of the ship. Presumably he's got quite a lot to lose if this goes wrong, namely a ship. And so he's got quite a lot to lose. So you've got an expert and someone with a lot to lose, both saying, no, this is going to be fine. You should go for it. And then we're told something else interesting, I think, which is in verse 12. We're told that not only do you have the experts and the owner, you also have the fact that the majority of people think they should sail. So on a purely democratic basis, if we were to put it to a vote, sailing passes. The majority of people think they should set sail. So you've got the experts, you've got the owner, you've got the majority. And then added into this, you actually want to set sail yourself. He doesn't want to stay in this harbor. He wants to keep going. It's a pretty powerful sort of triumvirate, isn't it? The experts, the majority, all telling you to do the thing that you actually want to do anyway. I mean, who's going to resist that? I want to do this thing. Experts are telling me that I should do this. The majority is in favor of me doing this. Of course I'm going to do that thing. It's pretty hard to resist. But here's the problem with that as a kind of way of viewing the world and a way of making decisions. What the experts advise and what the majority think is incredibly culturally contingent. So by that I mean the advice of experts and the views of the majority of the people has a lot more to say about the kind of culture you live in than it does about what the right course of action ever is. This is true of the most ordinary decisions you will face in your life. Let's imagine one for a minute. Imagine you're walking through Hartlepool Town Centre and you see a homeless person on the side of the road asking for money. There are a number of things you could do in this situation. You could just walk past, try and avoid eye contact. You could give them some money. You could strike up a conversation. You know, ask them a little bit about what's going on, maybe try and make some sort of connection. You could invite them to your house. There's lots of things you could do. The question is, what are you going to do? I just want you to imagine some different cultures. What you would choose to do in this situation would be incredibly different depending on where and when you lived. So if you live in 21st century Hartlepool, you will have a view as to what you think the right thing to do in that situation is, and you will act on the basis of that. That may well be different even to what most people in 21st century London might do, where they have a much bigger homeless population. That might have a huge impact on how people connect with it. I was struck when I was on the tubes in London last weekend that they had a whole thing around the top just saying, like, don't give money to homeless people, instead support these charities or link them up with this organisation. You know, it's just different because it's a different scale of problem, a different kind of setup down there. But then imagine that you don't go to 21st century London. Imagine if you go to 21st century Afghanistan. You're going to get quite a different set of advice on how you deal with homeless people and what you should do in that situation than you would in 21st century Hartlepool. Let's now not just change geographically where we are, let's change where we are in history. Imagine if you go to Nazi Germany. You know, 100 years ago, less than, not as far away, you're going to get a whole different set of what the experts are telling you to do and what the majority think you should do is going to be entirely different to what it is right now. And that's only a few years and a few hundred miles. Or let's keep the geography the same, but change history a little bit more. 11th century Hartlepool. Again, you're going to get a completely different view of what you should do, what the experts think you should do, and what the majority of people think you should do. It turns out that what experts advise and what the majority think has a lot more to do with where you happen to live and when you happen to live than anything else. It has much more to do with the geography and history that you happen to be a part of than it does with what is right and wrong to do in that situation. And this is the problem. And so the question is, what's the alternative? What's the alternative to just listening to experts, following the majority? Because I want to make it clear, I'm not anti-expert. Like, I think there is a growing trend in our culture that is really anti-expert. You know, what do they know? Why should I listen to doctors? Maybe because of their 7 years of medical training. I don't know. But I'm not anti-expert, but there must be a difference, right? There must be another way to do it. And the Bible tells the story of a God who made the heavens and the earth. Of the God who rules over all of creation and sees not a tiny bit of geography and a tiny bit of time, but all of geography and all of time. His advice, his guidance, his rules, they are not culturally contingent. They're not limited by cultures and geography. And therefore, they are universally true and eternally relevant. And that is why when Paul says, I can see our voyage is going to be disastrous, the centurion should ultimately have listened to him. Now, it's interesting. There were, of course, actual good reasons to listen to Paul. It wasn't just that God had told him this, although he had. There were good reasons. It was a dangerous time to go sailing. Everyone knew it was a dangerous time to go sailing. The problem wasn't so much that what Paul was saying was impossible to believe. It was much more that it wasn't what they wanted to believe. They wanted to set sail, and so they found the voices that encouraged them to do that. Now, the implications of all of this are obvious, but I do just want to take a minute or two just to spell them out. If you are a Christian here today, so if you are someone here this afternoon who would say, yep, I know Jesus, I follow him, I want to be one of his people, and I am one of his people, then the very straightforward implication of this is that the ultimate authority for everything in your life is the God who created you and loves you. That's your ultimate authority, even above the majority opinion of the culture that you happen to live in. Even above the experts who offer advice on a great many things. Whilst there might be a whole load of things you can learn from experts, and there might be a whole load of things you can gain from what the people around you believe, what they know is always going to be incredibly limited compared to what God knows. And we need to be careful that we don't act like the centurion, decide what we want to happen, and then surround ourselves with people advising us to do the very thing we've already decided we want to do. Instead, we need to, like Paul, sit under God's authority. Listen to what he says. Allow that to set the direction of our lives, even when that feels hard and strange. So if you're a Christian, that's just what it means. That's what it means to be a Christian. It means to submit to God's authority as the one who is not limited by the space and time he happens to exist in. If you are not a Christian here today, so if you're someone who's like still thinking about that, exploring it, still trying to work out what you believe, then this is important because this is likely to be one of the things you will battle with as you think about whether you're going to follow Jesus or not. Because there will be things which God says, and you'll hear them, and you'll go, that makes complete sense to me. In fact, it was what I thought all along. And it's also what most people around me think. But there will also be things that aren't like that. There will be things God says which you find difficult to believe, difficult to accept, and difficult to obey. There will be truths that God teaches which are not believed by the experts or by the majority, and that is simply because God is not culturally contingent. He doesn't mold himself to the culture you happen to live in. He refuses to just fall in line with the dominant culture of the time. And at some point, if you're still thinking about becoming a Christian, you're going to have to decide, who am I going to listen to? Because God will not always agree with you. And he won't always agree with the experts. And he won't always agree with the majority. At some point, you're going to have to decide, ultimately, am I going to listen to God, or am I going to listen to the culture I happen to live in? So, they've got this decision, and what do? Well, they listen to the pilot and they set off. Let's read on. We're on to the storm now, verse 13. When a gentle south wind began to blow, they saw their opportunity. So they weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. Before very long, a wind of hurricane force called the Northeaster swept down from the island. The ship was caught by the storm and could not head into the wind, so we gave way to it and were driven along. As we passed to the lee of a small island called Corda, we were hardly able to make the lifeboat secure. So the men hoisted it aboard, and then they passed ropes under the ship itself to hold it together. Because they were afraid that they would run aground on the sandbars of Syrtis, they lowered the sea anchor and let the ship be driven along. We took such a violent battering from the storm that the next day they began to throw the cargo overboard. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor star appeared for many days and the storm continued raging, we finally gave up all hope of being saved. After they had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, "Men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourself this damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. Last night, an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood beside me and said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar, and God has graciously given you the lives of all you sail with. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island.'" So what happens next in this story? Okay, they set sail, and before very long, a gentle breeze comes along, they set off, but then it starts getting pretty sketchy pretty quickly. A storm comes, and they have, in the end, they have no option but just to go where the storm like leads them. They chuck an anchor overboard, so they're not going too fast, and they just get blown. Wherever the storm's going to send them, that's where they're going to go. The image of them trying to like tie the ship together with ropes sounds to me pretty terrifying. If someone started doing that in a ship I was in, I wouldn't feel super secure. And so things get worse and worse. And after a few days, they start to fear for their lives. Desperate measures are taken to preserve the ships until things get so kind of perilous that they basically give up hope of being rescued and of coming out of it alive. We read that in verse 20. We finally gave up all hope of being saved. All hope is gone. It's over. They picked the wrong horse, and now it's all going to end. But here, at this moment, verse 20, when all hope is gone, suddenly Paul stands up. And what we get here is this amazing demonstration of God's grace. Paul stands up and he says, I love how he starts. He says, "You remember what I said back there? You should have listened to that." like not wanting to say, "I told you so," but I kind of told you so. That's where he starts. He says, "Look, you should have listened to me. You should have listened to me, but God has graciously determined that every single one of you is going to be saved. None of you are going to be lost to this storm. So take courage. Don't despair. Press on." And you see, in this little story, we get such an insight into God's character, because it would have been so easy for God to say, "Look, I kind of told you not to do this, and now you have, so it's sort of on you. Like, I washed my hands of it. Like, I told you what to do, you decided to go your own way, so this is your problem, you sort it out. Fine, you're going to ignore me, well now you can deal with the consequences. You want to make your own decisions? You want to go your own way? You want to listen and obey someone else? Well, that's fine, but you're going to have to be okay with living with the consequences." And yet that is not what God does. No, their actions do have consequences. It turns out if you decide to sail during the dangerous season, there's a reasonable chance that you're going to get hit by a storm. And that's what happens. Yet even in the midst of those consequences, in the midst of this storm, God extends grace and he offers a rescue to all of them. I just want to just make this clear for everyone who sat here this afternoon. The same is true for each one of us. Maybe as you look back on your life, what you see is you listening to one wrong person after another. Maybe you look back at your life and it's just a collection of you taking the wrong path. You look back and you're like, oh, I know I should have done that thing, but I actually did that thing. And then I know I should have done that thing, but then I did that thing. And you look back at your life and it's just one misturn after another misturn. And maybe you've now spent your whole life dealing with the consequences of that. Broken relationships, dashed dreams, mental health struggles, all the consequences that come from you having listened to the wrong people and chosen the wrong paths. And yet, in the midst of that, God still extends an offer of grace. God still reaches out to you in the chaos of all those storms, of all those consequences, and he says to you, don't despair. God reaches out to you and says, it's not too late. I love you, and I died for you, and there is forgiveness for each and every one of those mistakes. More than that, there's not only forgiveness, there is redemption and renewal for each one of those consequences. To take the picture here, the ship might be broken, but you don't have to be. Rather, you can be healed and renewed, and one day resurrected in a world where you are finally free from each and every storm, where you will finally experience the life you longed for. If as you look back at your life, you just go, hey, I just listened to all the wrong people, I made all the wrong decisions, and now my life is such a mess. Hear this little sign of God's grace in the middle of that saying, wait a minute, rescue is still available. Salvation's still there for you. Renewal and healing and hope is still available. Maybe it's slightly different for you. Maybe you look back in your life and you go, actually, maybe that my life was kind of fine. But maybe your situation is right now, at this moment, you are ignoring God. Maybe there's an area of your life you're just disobeying him in. You're like, I don't want to do what God wants me to do in that, and I'm not going to. You're pressing off in your own direction. Maybe you've chosen the advice of experts and cultural norms over obedience to God. Maybe that's the reality. You've just assimilated with the culture around you. You've gone, hey, I'm just going to do what everyone else is doing and what all the people who matter are telling me to do. Well, again, I want you to hear the word of hope here. God has not given up on you. Even if you are right now walking away from him, he hasn't given up on you. He hasn't written you off. He isn't just up in heaven looking for a way to make you pay for the way that you've rejected him. That's not how God works. He's actually right next to you, even in your rebellion, extending grace. He's right there next to you, calling you back to him, looking to shelter and protect you, maybe from some of the consequences of those actions, or maybe he's just offering you comfort and hope in the middle of that. That moment where you realize, hey, I thought I was walking into a gentle breeze, but it turns out it was actually a storm. That's how God tends to work. I think we need to understand this. Often our actions have consequences, because that's what makes life meaningful. You know, that whole cause and effect thing. You do things and then certain things happen. If that wasn't the case, life wouldn't really work. Often our actions do have consequences. And often what we want from God is we want him to spare us from the consequences of those actions. And sometimes he does do that, but more often what he does is what he does here in Acts 27. He extends grace in the middle of those consequences. He doesn't save us from the storm, but he offers us rescue and comfort and redemption in the middle of it. That's how God so often works. Let's get to the end. So let's carry on reading verse 27. Let's get to the shipwreck. On the 14th night, we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea, when about midnight, the sailors sensed they were approaching land. They took soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. A short time later, they took soundings again and found that it was 90 feet deep. Fearing that we would be dashed against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight. In an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down into the sea, pretending they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. Then Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved." So the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it drift away. Just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. For the last 14 days, he said, you've been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head. After he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of them all, and then he broke it and began to eat. They were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. When they had eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. When daylight came, they did not recognize the land, but they saw a bay with a sandy beach where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. Cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea and at the same time untied the ropes that held the rudders. Then they hoisted the foresail to the wind and made for the beach. But the ship struck a sandbar and ran aground. The bow stuck fast and would not move, and the stern was broken to pieces by the pounding of the surf. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping. But the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land. The rest were to get there on planks or on other pieces of the ship. In this way, everyone reached land safely. So there you go. We're basically done for this week. The voyage reaches its dramatic conclusion. The ship is smashed to pieces, but the people escape. They swim to shore, and we're going to leave them here on this mysterious island, which turns out to be Malta. But I just want you to notice quickly before we finish the full reversal that's taken place from the start to here. Because at the start, Paul says to the centurion, hey, this is what you should do. You shouldn't set sail. And the centurion goes, not listening to you. But here, verse 31, Paul tells the centurion that the sailors must not be allowed to escape in a lifeboat. And what does the centurion do? He listens. And he cuts away the lifeboats. And in verse 33 to 38, Paul encourages them to eat and reassures them that God will protect them. And what do? They listen and they eat and they're encouraged. This is the kind of story that Acts 27 has taken us on, from Paul not being listened to Paul being listened to. That's kind of the flow of the story. That's what it's all about. You see, what's happened through this storm? Well, a lesson's been taught and a lesson's been learnt. And the lesson's pretty straightforward. The sailors and centurion have finally reached the end of themselves. They've realized how helpless they are. And now, only now, once they've realized that, are they able to actually listen to what God is saying to them. If you've come here this afternoon and you're like, I don't know why I'm here, or you don't know what to expect, here's what we would want to do. We want to look at the Bible and we want to go, what's God saying? What's God saying to us from this passage? And if you want to learn the lesson of Acts 27, I want to suggest that there's two things you need to learn from this. Here's the first thing. You need to hear a warning. Ignoring and disobeying God might look pretty appealing. It might look like a gentle breeze, but it will ultimately always take you into a storm. You've got to hear the warning of Acts 27. Not listening to God, going your own way. Hey, I get it. Sometimes it looks like a gentle breeze. It looks like just what you want. And you set off into it, it will always lead you to a storm. We've got to hear the warning of Acts 27, and we've got to hear the encouragement of Acts 27. God is not going to abandon you in your storms. Even when those storms are of your own making. See, once you've learned those two things, once you've learned those two truths, then you've begun to gain the kind of wisdom that the Bible talks about. The wisdom that's required to listen to God and obey him, even when it runs contrary to what we think, contrary to what we want, contrary to the wisdom of our culture